is part of a larger plan to stop Yemen's army advancement towards the city of Marib. Yemenis will not give in to these pressures. The mediator must be neutral, but the US is biased towards the Saudi-led coalition.
Yemen has said the USB's major responsibility for the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Yemen as it supports the Saudi blockade on the war-torn country. They called on the international community to prosecute the US for committing war crimes against the women and the children of Yemen.
The US State Department is not a position to accuse Ansarullah movement because the war in Yemen has been led by the US. Therefore, the US is involved in the war and cannot serve as a mediator. We call on the international community to put the U.S. on trial over committing war crimes against Yemeni children and women.
Earlier, the head of the Yemeni negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman said the other parties are haggling over the suffering of millions of Yemenis for military gains, adding that it is the right of all Yemenis to obtain food, medicine and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Yemenis say the U.S. has no right to blame them as it is one of the parties of the current war on their country. They believe that bargaining over their suffering is a clear violation of the international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of associations of Palestinians from across Italy jointly organized a demonstration in solidarity with the people of Palestine. A large crowd flooded in Rome's iconic San Giovanni Square to hold a rally dubbed Stop the Occupation, Free Palestine, Jerusalem or Quds is our capital. Protesters held banners and placards reading Stop the War and Sanctions on Israel.
Politicians, trade union members, anti-war campaigners, people from all walks of life have joined the demonstration demanding justice for Palestinians. They are calling on the Italian government to take a firm stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
I think it is a matter of political opportunism. That's why Italy's support to Palestine has been shifting towards positions inconsistent with those held in the past. There is also a lack of commitment on the part of the moderate political forces that used to hold a balanced stance on the conflict. The rise of right-wing parties and their alignment with Netanyahu's government has changed the dynamics entirely.
Unfortunately, we know full well how economic interests play a crucial role in foreign policy. But we have some good news finally, as on June 2nd, the European Trade Union Confederation issued a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. Also, working movements are shifting towards pro-Palestinian positions.
Protesters also called on EU member states to impose sanctions on Israel to put an end to what they called a flagrant violation of international law taking place in Palestine. Tens of demonstrations in solidarity with Palestine have been held across Italy in recent days. About 2 weeks ago, pro-Palestine groups staged protests at the Rai national broadcaster headquarters and branches in several Italian cities, complaining that the persecution of Palestinians has been sugar-coated in Israel's favor by the public television company. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of British pro-Palestine activists amassed outside a notorious arms manufacturer near Blackburn on Friday, demanding an end to Israeli arms sales. Anger was vented in various ways, including with a funeral procession honoring the recent martyrdom of over 60 children slain in Gaza.
It's a genocide that's occurring before our eyes. Companies like BAE Systems are complicit in what's going on there. They're providing illegal weaponry.
Now they've been exposed, the Zionist regime, because from footage from underground, from Gaza, has come out. And people are starting to realize that this is an apartheid, ethnic cleansing, colonialism regime that is operating, and it has to end.
Today, we came here to send a message to the world. What is the mistake of these children? 64 children have been killed innocent. Some of them were sleeping in the hands of their parents, and they found themselves dead. Why? One, the answer is occupation. End occupation, everything will be sorted out.
BAE Systems is one of Britain's biggest arms dealers and is known for building weapons used by Middle Eastern regimes to target innocent civilians in conflict zones.
Essentially here to register our protest and say to BAE Systems and to the government that this is simply unacceptable, that weapons manufactured here in Lancashire, here in England, should be used against civilians in Gaza and in Palestine.
This is the second week that local residents have come in good numbers to condemn BAE Systems, and more action is being planned. Major arms firms such as this have been heavily criticized many times in the past. However, it's very rare for protest movements of this size and frequency to engage in such regular and very direct action. Now, these locals are coming out in numbers, hoping to force a change which will inevitably save lives in places like Palestine and elsewhere too. Robert Carter, Blackburn.
With only less than 2 weeks to go before Iran's presidential elections, the seven candidates have expressed their views and plans in conferences, TV programs, and interviews. Some have criticized the current economic policies, while others pledged to make some fundamental reforms if elected. Mohsen Mehralizadeh said he would seek de-escalation between Iran and other countries, noting that the government should not let for some factors to detach the country from the rest of the world. He also pledged to form a cabinet made of experienced people who are able to solve people's problems. Ebrahim Raisi pledged to do his utmost to end the corruption in the country. He also pointed out the issue of unemployment as a major problem young Iranians are struggling with. He vowed to help the youth with their employment and housing problems. Raisi stressed that his first priority would be people's livelihoods and welfare. Alireza Zakani, who is currently serving as a parliament member, said he would seek a comprehensive progress of the country. He also criticized Iran's current foreign policy and stressed that the country's foreign policy should serve the economy, culture, society, politics, and security by taking a broader horizon into consideration. Former central bank governor Abdel Nasser Himmati said he is a reformist and his main agenda is economic reforms. He called on Iranians to support him with their votes. Himmati noted the mass COVID-19 vaccination would be his first plan after winning the race. Another candidate, Amir Hossein Qazizadeh Hashemi, said his main goal is to support the people by reducing household expenses and increasing purchasing power. He also pledged to eliminate economic rent-seeking and lessen the government's interference in the process of production, imports, and distribution of goods. Former top nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili called for a strategy in which people can observe and monitor the performance of the government. However, he called on Iranian people not to wait for anyone and continue their efforts towards the development of the country, regardless of who is going to win the presidential race. Mohsen Rezaei criticized former and current administrations for adopting wrong economic policies. Rezaei said such measures have caused economic hardships Iranians have been dealing with for years. The 66-year-old hopeful also called for unity among Iranians in order to be able to overcome the economic crisis.
Squalid accommodation that was not fit to house human beings fleeing persecution. That was how lawyers representing six asylum seekers described Napier Military Barracks in Kent in a case brought to the British High Court. In a landmark ruling, Mr. Justice Lyndon agreed and said all of them were
vulnerable victims of trafficking and or torture who experienced a deterioration in their mental health as a result of their accommodation at Napier Barracks.
Napier Barracks has turned into a resident site for vulnerable asylum seekers, despite a warning from Public Health England that the dormitories were not suitable accommodation during a pandemic. However, the court found that this advice was not followed, leading to a COVID outbreak infecting half the residents.
The Home Office responded to the ruling with this statement.
Throughout this period, our accommodation providers and subcontractors have made improvements to the site and continue to do so. It is disappointing that this judgment was reached on the basis of the site prior to the significant improvement works which have taken place in difficult circumstances. Napier will continue to operate and provide safe and secure accommodation. We will carefully consider the ruling and our next steps.
Human rights campaigner Adam Yassir, came to the UK as a refugee from Darfur in Sudan. He's been supporting asylum seekers who've been staying at Napier Barracks and gave a witness testimony to the High Court.
Multiple asylum seekers asked me to provide a noise cancellation earplugs, and I asked, and they said, the guys said to me, some people scream at night, they've got PTSD.
Calls are mounting for the Home Office to shut down the controversial barracks after a damning court ruling found that they had acted unlawfully and irrationally, which could potentially lead to damages against the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel.
They felt they need to, they've been used to send message to other asylum seekers, people who are trying to seek safety and security in the UK. But it is the wrong way. It is breaking the law to make a point. It's not the right way, and it isn't working at all. It isn't working. Hence, someone needs to be accountable, and the Home Secretary should actually consider her position.
The ruling by the High Court will be a vindication for lawyers, rights groups, and activists alike, who for too long have had their concerns regarding Napier Barracks ignored. But they will still feel their fight is far from over, while asylum seekers still remain housed there in what the court described as appalling conditions. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In a year not short of drama, the British royal family is embroiled in yet another scandal, claims of historical racism. Unearthing documents in the UK National Archives, The Guardian has revealed palace officials ban, quote, coloured immigrants or foreigners from serving in clerical roles in the royal household until at least the late 1960s. Instead, they were permitted to work as domestic servants.
In the optics of what the royal family has been about, I mean, just a knowledge of history would tell you that it's a highly racialized institution. And regardless of the fact that the Queen runs a Commonwealth, which is a majority of minority ethnic background vis-a-vis the Brits, that would be black and so on, it doesn't surprise me at all.
The ban was eventually ended, but Buckingham Palace has refused to say when, only that its records show employment of ethnic minorities started in the 1990s and that it did not keep records on staff members' race from the decades prior. The archive documents also reveal Queen Elizabeth II has been exempt from race and gender equality laws since their introduction in the kingdom in the 1970s, prohibiting individuals working for her household from suing on discrimination grounds. That exception remains in place to this day.
What is happening is that across the world, people are taking a different view of the royal family. And as she is in charge of the Commonwealth, it does not bode well for the future of the Commonwealth at all.
The new findings come on the heels of allegations earlier this year of racism within the ranks of the royal family from two of its members.
And also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
And of silence and denials from other members.
Very much not to make
this
happen.
This week, the Queen will be marking a huge annual spectacle celebrating decades of her reign. Will the new revelations put a damper on the British monarch's so-called platinum jubilee? Saipur is up, London.
The race for the top executive post in Iran rages on among the seven candidates who appear before reporters every day to outline their plans. Plans for a brighter future, stronger economy, and more opportunities for the youth. So journalists rarely ask contenders about what they have done in the past, but what they will do should they win the election.
The first move that my administration will focus on is to uproot poverty in the first year. If poverty is eliminated, our people will excel in culture and enlightenment.
I will pay special attention to the youth and their problems. Unemployment is now the first and foremost issue of our youth. As an economist, I believe that if we remove the uncertainty in our market, we can easily create jobs. Also, I will allow young experts to run at least 50% of my cabinet.
All of the candidates have so far spoken of problems that they blame on the incumbent government. Problems that range from inflation to unemployment. Some of the contenders find the root cause of these problems in the fact that outgoing President Rouhani has put all his eggs in the basket of the 2015 nuclear deal, which is now hanging by a thread.
Nobody can ignore the negative effects of the sanctions on our economy. But at the same time, we cannot reach out to our enemy and appeal to them to lift the sanctions. This method has not worked and will not work. We cannot pin hope on the lifting of sanctions to fix our economy. We should have relied on our own domestic capacities to have a resilient economy.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Based on the guidelines set by the Coronavirus Combat Committee, campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th. The Islamic Republic holds an average of one election each year since its establishment in 1979. Now candidates call on Iranians to turn up en masse for this year's election, as in the previous rounds, since high voter turnout is translated into a seal of approval for the legitimacy of the Islamic establishment. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yair Lapid, the leader of Israeli opposition Yesh Atid party, informed the Israeli president that he can form a coalition cabinet. This brings to an end the era of long-time Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under the coalition agreement, Lapid will share power with head of the right-wing Yamina, Naftali Bennett, who would be Netanyahu's immediate replacement. For the Palestinians, however, Netanyahu's removal would be no improvement, especially that the coming Prime Minister Bennett, who was a former settler leader, rejects Palestinian statehood. Palestinian officials say they expect Bennett's cabinet will even be more extreme than Netanyahu's.
For us, this coalition cabinet that was declared to replace Netanyahu's radical cabinet is even more radical when it comes to Israel's policies towards Palestinians. It will seek to expand settlements in the occupied lands. We trust none of Israeli parties. Their policy towards Palestinians won't be different.
Experts say that for the time being, Netanyahu's successors with their disparate agendas are expected to leave contentious issues unresolved. According to them, Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. His aim instead is to take full control of Palestinians. Moreover, they say, Bennett has some red lines he will never cross. He has long championed the right of settlement in the West Bank.
There's a consensus among all far-right parties when it comes to policies towards Palestinians. The two parties have already agreed to keep Area C of the West Bank under their control, which makes up almost 58% of the West Bank. The new cabinet will press ahead with the annexation plan, which is part of the so-called deal of the century.
Under the coalition agreement, Bennett and Lapid would rotate the role of prime minister, with Bennett taking up the post for the first 2 years and Lapid the final two. Experts say Netanyahu will not let it go easily, as the parliament still has about 12 days to swear in the cabinet. During this period, Netanyahu will do his utmost to convince enough right-wing lawmakers to vote against the new cabinet. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
Goodness. I've been looking for this necklace for a long time, and this drawer was the only place that I hadn't searched inside. This turquoise necklace is a family memo. My grandma has gifted it to me. Actually, she has also been gifted this necklace by her grandma. The turquoise in this necklace is natural. It's Nishabur's turquoise. Tomorrow we are going to Khorasan Razavi province, to the city of Nishabur, where these beautiful turquoise gemstones come from. Turquoise, which in old Persian is called piruze, is a mineral that is a hydrated phosphate of copper or aluminum. This rare, valuable mineral can be found in sky blue, green, and blue to green colors. This mineral is treated by jewelers and then used as a gemstone in ornaments. The turquoise of Nishabur is one of the most high-grade turquoise of the world. Turquoise has two types. Ajami turquoise, which is smooth, and Shajari turquoise, which is veiny, that is extracted and processed. Ajami turquoise is the most popular turquoise in Iran. The big old turquoise mine of Nishabur is located in a village called Ma'dan-e-Oliya. This village is situated in Firuze County, which is 20 kilometers to Nishabur. The turquoise mine of Nishabur is one of the oldest turquoise mines in the world. I am now by the entrance of the turquoise mine in the Ma'dan-e-Oliya village. I'm yearning to see what these beautiful blue gemstones look like in the mine. Let's go inside. Looks like a cave. Here there is a long tunnel with two creeks flowing by its sides. The entire tunnel is equipped with electrical installations, and there is a light on perimeter of the tunnel. A worker is cutting off a rock from the wall by a hatchet. Oh, look at here. This wall has blue veins on it. It's turquoise.
We extract turquoise from here and then we deliver it to the storage. The next group is in charge of classifying these stones by their grade.
I am now in a site where the collected gemstones are put in a machine where they are washed by water. These stones are then taken to the village, where the men and women of the village separate the turquoise from inside the rock and then treat them. I wish my grandma was here so that she could see with how much difficulty her beautiful turquoise necklace is made. She would wonder if I tell her the story of turquoise. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Netanyahu has been in office for 12 years. His opponents despise him and want him out of office. The longtime premier is also facing corruption charges. Four elections have been held in 2 years, with Netanyahu hoping to garner enough votes to achieve a Knesset majority to lead a stable government, but to no avail. Lapid has mustered the backing of 8 political parties, winning 61 votes in the 120-seat legislature. Now, are Netanyahu's days in office being numbered? Would it make any difference for the Palestinians who takes office as Israeli Prime Minister? Stay tuned for a debate on relevant issues. Let's go to Ramallah, and we have our correspondent Mona Kendall there. Mona, tell us about how things are in terms of the topic of our discussion.
Known to be a settler leader and the head of the right-wing Yamin party, he is well known to be supporting the settlers. He completely rejects a Palestinian statehood. Palestinian officials have been saying that they even expect that Bennett's cabinet would be even more extreme than Netanyahu's regimes, especially that Bennett will do his utmost to convince the settlers that he's even more radical than Netanyahu, and he will continue to support the settlers' rights. He would continue to give a green light for more confiscation of the land. However, experts are saying that Netanyahu will not let it go easily, especially that the parliament, the Israeli Knesset, still have several days before voting for and the swearing in the cabinet. Netanyahu would be trying during this period to convince more lawmakers in the Knesset in order to vote against the upcoming Israeli cabinet.
Correspondent Ramallah. Well, I'm going to invite one of our guests to tonight's debate, Charlotte Cates, international coordinator of the Summit on Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network in Vancouver, joining us. Good to have you with us. As you know, Lapid has a hair's breadth majority, making him and his coalition vulnerable, and that's what Netanyahu and his allies are counting on by pressuring the Imina party to defect. Would Netanyahu be lucky enough to do that?
They may be able to do that, they may not. What we are seeing taking place inside the Zionist political system today is not any kind of conflict over principles. It's not any kind of struggle over, like, the fundamentals, the nature of the Zionist state, the nature of Israeli apartheid, the nature of colonialism and racism, the crimes being perpetrated against the Palestinian people. Instead, what we're seeing is kind of petty political spats over power and control between forces that on very fundamental issues share much of the same program and much of the same reality. And so it may be possible that Netanyahu was able to sway some of the fellow far-right members of the Yamina party to, you know, vote against this agreement and stay with Netanyahu. It could be possible. It may fail. What we've seen again and again, however, is that the same threat is being posed to the Palestinian people, whether that threat takes the name Netanyahu or the name or that takes the name Naftali Bennett or, for that matter, Yair Lapid.
Okay. And now let me invite our second guest. We have also Gilad Atzmon, author and political analyst, joining us from London. Good to have you with us, Gilad. Netanyahu has embarked in fierce online attacks on his opponents. How serious would you expect political infighting in Tel Aviv to be?
It's hard to say. I can tell you that the Israeli internal security services are very worried about it. As you probably know, the chief of this organization already announcing yesterday, I think, that the situation is becoming very tense. I think that people have to understand that the dispute in Israel is not political. 80 Knesset members are extreme right-wing, most of them right of Netanyahu, all right? Bennett is right of Netanyahu. The issue with Netanyahu is that he managed to run into personal disputes with his closest allies to the point that they are not happy to sit with him in a government. Netanyahu is facing a serious legal obstacle. He may end up in jail. He will do everything within his capacity to prevent the change of power. We may as well see violence, and it won't be the first time.
Okay. Now, Charlotte, some observers maintain that the 11-day aggression in May indicated the fact that Tel Aviv government is less stable than it seems to be, and its defenses more vulnerable than expected. Let's have your take.
Well, that is certainly true. I mean, the Palestinian resistance made very clear that the, you know, supposedly strong nature of the Zionist project is in fact increasingly vulnerable to the Palestinian resistance itself and to all of the forces in the region and around the world. The reality is that Israel can fall. The Zionist state can fall. Palestinians can win and liberate Palestine. And that's one of the things that the resistance made very clear in that it did extract serious achievements, despite the fact that in many ways Netanyahu pursued this course of empowering the most blatantly extreme and racist settlers to go on rampages throughout Jerusalem, attacking Al-Aqsa Mosque. And this was all in an attempt to bolster essentially his, to cash in on attacks on Palestinians, to cash in on the ongoing Nakba, to cash in on ethnic cleansing in order to stay in place in his position in the government. But the reality is that the Palestinian people, the Palestinian resistance, all regional forces supporting the resistance, and people around the world made very clear that this is not a way forward. This is only a way toward the inevitable and eventual collapse of the Zionist project.
Now, Gilad, let me ask you this. Did the recent aggression against the Palestinians help Netanyahu and his allies' agenda or hurt them?
I think that Netanyahu is a pretty incredible strategist, cold blood, and I don't have any doubt that in his mind such a conflict would could potentially, and in fact it did, and in the first days, destabilize the new coalition, the imagined coalition under Lapid. So we saw it 2, 3, 4 days, I don't remember exactly when it was, when it happened, into these recent clashes in Gaza, this criminal Israeli attack. Bennett kind of announced that he's going back to the right, but then it took a few days and he ended up in a dispute with Netanyahu, and he found his way back to the change government, to this new coalition. It is not a political battle. In Israel, there is no left. The only left party in Israel is actually the Arab United List. We are talking about 5-6 Knesset members. The Jewish left, like Meretz and maybe the Labor, that used to be kind of pro-reconciliation and so on, have morphed into LGBTQ parties. They are identitarians. They care a lot for gays and lesbians and trans. They don't care that much or even at all about the Palestinian conflict. There was a sense in the last few years that the Palestinian cause has evaporated, and one of the cleverest analysts in Israel, Amos Yadlin, ex-intelligence commander and a pilot, he actually wrote in the beginning of the recent clashes, he wrote, those who fell into this delusion that the Palestinian crisis evaporated or the Palestinian cause is kind of subsided can see the truth. And the truth of the matter is the Palestinians are now stronger than ever. What we saw in the recent weeks was a united front, and this is something that wasn't seen in Palestine since 1936.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, Charlotte, some argue that Netanyahu governed through manipulation of fear, making the people feel that survival would be impossible in his absence. Do you agree?
Well, it's certainly the case that racist and right-wing forces, you know, govern from the perspective of essentially reversing the perpetrator and the victim. So thereby, the colonial power that has been attacking and oppressing and usurping Palestinian land and rights and attacking and imprisoning Palestinian people for over 73 years is being portrayed as the potential victim of attacks, you know, rather than the colonizer and the usurper. And of course, we see the same thing in the United States, we see it in Canada, we see it in Europe. So there's no, that's not surprising. The Zionist project, especially, you know, in relation to Palestinians and Arabs, has always relied on this kind of racist rhetoric. And so we see, in fact, this large volumes of support among the Israeli population for, you know, as far right as you can possibly go. I mean, it's worth thinking back just a few years ago. Naftali Bennett was considered, you know, the guy who was too extreme to be considered to be in the Knesset, and now he's being talked about as a hope to replace Netanyahu, you know, who could seek peace. And obviously, this is nonsense. The only way to seek peace is by defeating Zionism, and by defeating Israel, and by supporting the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea.
Like Gilad, what would be the fate of the two-state solution with a new government in Tel Aviv? Would Mr. Bennett ever accept the formation of a Palestinian state?
I think that no one between the river and the sea, and I'm talking about Israelis as well, of course, do consider the option of the two-state solution as a realistic option. We are dealing with a one state. Israel is one state. It has one electric grid, one telephone pre-code, one sewage system. Israel is one state that is at the moment under the rule of an ideologically driven racist ideology. However, the number of the Palestinian, the demography there is changing radically. And at the moment, we already have a majority of non-Jews and basically Palestinians between the river and the sea, and it's hard to say when will this majority capitalize on its power, because it's not a democratic state and it has never been one, but it is just a question of time before this state that identified itself now as a Jewish state will morph into something quite different, and I believe that this different thing will be called Palestine.
Now, Charlotte, what's your opinion? When Mr. Bennett takes office as Prime Minister, what kind of change could we expect?
I think that we can expect more of the same, unfortunately. We can expect more of the same because we've been seeing the same thing for the past 73 years. And so what that means is we can expect more mass imprisonment, more land confiscation, more home demolitions. We can expect, you know, more attempts to further repress and silence and repress the Palestinian people. We can also expect that there may be some growing international pressure on the Israeli state, which, of course, as we know, receives $3.8 billion a year in military aid from the United States, is very reliant on its connections with Western imperialist powers as this colonial settler project in the region. And so the fact that there are literally millions of people taking to the streets inside the United States and Europe and Canada is also a mechanism of pressure to support the Palestinian resistance and support the Palestinian people, because it does place further pressure on even those governments that have been fully complicit in all of Israel's crimes over the past 73 years, and in fact have funded, supported, and planned them together, to you know, counsel sort of taking a step back in this sense. But what we can also see is the growing strength, resilience, and ability to transcend, whether it's prison bars, barriers, apartheid walls, or the over 14-year siege on Gaza, to continue to, and for that matter, the ongoing exile and expulsion of Palestinian refugees from their homes and lands for the past 73 years. Despite all of that, the Palestinian people have maintained their unity and, in fact, are maybe more united and stronger than ever in envisioning one clear solution. As you know, they say in demonstrations, there's only one solution, Intifada revolution. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And those might be the chants that we hear at demonstrations, but they also speak to the truth of the matter quite clearly.
Now, Gilad, we talk about Mr. Bennett. Now, what about the other person? What could change for Palestinians when Mr. Lapid takes charge as Israeli Prime Minister?
I must admit that the situation is not as clear as your other guest is presenting it. We have now Mansour Abbas, the leader of RAM and the Israeli Islamic Party, in the coalition, and the coalition more than likely will be dependent on the support, either external support or maybe they will join at one stage, of the Arab United List. Now, this means that this government, as it is presented at the moment, cannot be as brutal to Palestinians as some people may predict. The issue here is different. As I mentioned before, there are 80%, 80 Knesset members, like something like 72% of the Knesset members are ultra-right wing. Some, they are not more centered than Rabbi Kahana, that was seen as the most radical Jewish supremacist ever. Mm-hmm. Now, if Netanyahu disappears from the scene tomorrow, and this can happen if Netanyahu is out of power, is not anymore in the helm, he will probably disappear, and at that point there won't be any reason to keep this coalition, mm-hmm. and we will see immediately the rise of an ultra-right wing coalition in Israel. This is why Hamas actually sustained Benjamin Netanyahu in power. This is a fight that they handle. They handle very well. They win this battle. I think that we have to be very careful in the way we look at these issues and to try to avoid slogans. It's a very interesting political and military conflict in which the Palestinians are gaining, scoring points. The Israelis prove to be cowards. However, they sustain kind of a status quo. And this will change, not with Bennett in the coalition, but with the collapse of the next government and the rise of an ultra-right wing.
Gilad, if you allow me, we have 1 minute and one last question for Charlotte. If Knesset Charlotte backs the 8-party coalition, will it be possible for Palestinian citizens of Israel, who constitute 1/5 of the population, to be able to play a bigger role in politics?
The most meaningful role that Palestinians inside Occupy Palestine 48 have played is not by participating in the Knesset elections. On the contrary, it's been by rejecting the Knesset elections. And in fact, we saw a huge percentage of Palestinians boycotting the Knesset elections just this year. And we've seen a growing, once again, kind of resurgence in the rejection of the entire project of participating in the Knesset, because participating in the Knesset is participating in the parliament of the colonizer. And the movement to boycott the Knesset is, in fact, growing, getting stronger. And that means, being fully part of and with the entirety of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement inside and outside Palestine. And I think that that's really the way forward to a stronger role. And we saw just how strong that role can be in this recent uprising in the past weeks, when it was Palestinians in 48 in Haifa and Yaffa and Lid who took to the streets, who reclaimed their streets and fought back against the colonizers with incredible power and courage.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this debate. So let me thank our guests, Wed Gilad Atzmon, author and political analyst in London, and Charlotte Gates, international coordinator of the Summit on Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network in Vancouver, with their contribution. Drop in your host, Behrouz Najaf.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of